Hello, and welcome to the Planning Period Podcast, Episode 10. I'm thinking about Episode 10 as kind of the start of Season 2, or maybe Season 1.5. Either way, I have had a blast making the first 9 episodes of the show, but I think my best stuff is definitely ahead of me. With that in mind, I thought that the best way to start out the new year of the podcast and my own school year starting back up was by talking to someone who has reminded me roughly 362 times in the last 2 months that he doesn't have to go back to work this week. As of July 1st, my dad, who was an elementary school principal, assistant principal, dean, music teacher, and high school band director, retired. He was well respected and loved by his staff, and I'm not saying that because he's my dad, I'm saying that because I've seen the pictures of the swanky retirement party they threw him and the stack of presents he got, and oftentimes not so loved by all of his bosses. With his retirement date behind him, the need to sugarcoat his responses to my questions was gone, and he gave me some honest answers. From what he calls buying the lie to micromanaging, he talks about some of the biggest problems facing education, especially in Florida, but he also talks about the power of teachers to overcome these issues. I think we had some great conversations, and I hope you'll agree. So sit back and enjoy the Planning Period Podcast, Episode 10, as I interview my dad, Bob Schreffler. I am joined today by a very special guest I'm pretty excited about. After many years in teaching in various forms and phrases, my father is now a retired former elementary school principal, among other things, and I thought as a retired educator, he might be a great person to have on the show to talk a little bit about what education is really like and especially what it's been like during his career. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, Dad.
Okay. I started as a high school band director, high school and middle school band director for 8 years in Georgia. Then we moved to Orlando, and I actually wanted to be home with the boys once in a while, so I switched to elementary music. That was a heck of a transition. I did that for 9 years here in Florida. Towards the end of that, my principal said, "You need to get out of here." And I thought, what did I do wrong? She said, "No, I can tell you've got a system in place. You'll ride that system till you die, and you're going to be bored to death. You need something different. You should be an administrator," which I never really wanted to be, but I talked with her about it. And I looked into it, went ahead and got my master's here in Florida, and was a dean for 2 years, and an AP for 3, and a principal for 7. And those, the AP and principal, were all at the same school, so I was only an administrator ever at one school for 10 years.
Which, in of itself, I've always wondered how you made that happen, because that is not common in, certainly in our area, that is not a common experience.
I don't really know. I went in. The school opened the year before I went there, and it was big enough. It was up to 1,150 students, K-5, that they got a second assistant principal. So I came in at Thanksgiving in the second year. At the end of that year, we were losing kids to a new school. We're getting rezoned, so we had to cut back to one. And for whatever reason, the guy that opened the school got bumped somewhere else, and I got to stay. And then after, like I said, my first 3 years, the principal retired, and I was one of the ones that interviewed, and I really thought it was just a courtesy interview. He's been here, let him come in and interview for it, and got the job. So never asked why. Smarter than that.
Well, I know you have a lot of opinions as you've left, especially in the last few years. So, but we'll get into them. And actually, we'll probably start right away with some of your stronger ones with my first question. What is the biggest problem facing education right now?
I call it buying the lie. And there's two parts to buying the lie. The first part is that the only thing that matters in evaluating a child, a school, or a teacher is a test score. That's part one of buying the lie. Part two is worse, and that is that the belief that a teacher can somehow overcome everything else that happens in that child's life in the 6 hours we have them every day to get every single child on grade level, regardless of what country they came from, how much English they have, how many parents are or aren't at home, they're being raised by grandparents, on and on and on. And to me, that's one of the biggest problems. If we've lost sight of growth, and there was that whole thing with the new national person in charge of education, where she couldn't even articulate what's the difference between growth and proficiency, being on grade level. It used to be you wanted a kid to be on grade level or make a year's growth in a year's time and maybe a little more. So that in the elementary school, if a kid went into third grade a year or so behind, we get him a little closer by the time he gets to middle school. Maybe he's back on, or if he's 2 years behind, maybe it takes till he gets to high school. But the goal was eventually would get him there. But now everything has gone to everybody's got to be on grade level now, and that's just not possible. And it causes us to put pressure on teachers that to do things they just are, it's not possible for them to do.
Okay. I agree with you in the sense that we definitely can't overcome every issue. However, there is still a connection between a quality educator making a quality education for students. So
absolutely.
Where do we draw that line? Because we do need to be able to measure teachers in some way. We do need to show that teachers are showing growth. And there's no way from a district's perspective or a school perspective, in my eyes, to be able to account for all those variables either.
No, there's no way you can account for all of it. But there needs to be some way where... there has to be an understanding, and here's an example: the school grading policy, the way that it's used by the state, whether it's Florida or anywhere else, but I know Florida best. There's nothing in there that accounts for a Title I school that may be 100% free and reduced lunch, as mine were. Every single child in my school got free breakfast and lunch every day. There's nothing in there to account for that. There's nothing in there to account for language issues. I guarantee if my kids had been able to take the test each year in whatever their native language is or whatever they were stronger at the time, we'd have been an A every year without any problems. The problem is I'm testing a whole bunch of kids who the only English they get is at school. They don't even get it at home because their parents don't speak English. So we're expecting them, and the studies show it takes 6, 7, 8 years to acquire a language. Florida says after 1 year, you count with everybody else. That's expecting an awful lot from a little kid to do when they don't get it at home because they're going home and they're speaking Spanish because their parents are first generation. For example, the last couple of years, we've gotten a huge influx from Venezuela because of the terrible situation down there. These people are coming up here. They're so happy just to have a meal, a place to live, where the government's not completely falling apart. They're not even thinking academically for their kids. They're thinking, if my kid goes to school every day, he gets 2 free meals, he comes home and he's healthy and he's happy and he's safe, that's a successful school to them. And because none of that is ever taken into the school grade, you have a school like mine that has to compete with a school where the kids go on vacation to Europe every year. And I'm not saying mine school's the worst. Mine in the middle. There's some way, way further the other end from mine that... I mean, you look at the school grades year after year, and to me, I read a study once that said that the only reliable comparison between a school and a school grade is the zip code the school is in. You see all the time where schools jump from a D to an A or a B to an A or an F to a B or whatever from in 1 year, and they stay there maybe a year or two, and then they're right back where they were because you have to beat people up so much to get them there. They just can't sustain it because it always comes back to, I could look at the scores. When I looked at the scores last week when they came out, I could have told you which schools would be high, which schools would be low. The middle group changes around a little bit, but the low ones tend to stay low. The high ones tend to stay high. And I've not run into any teachers in 29 years that weren't doing the best they could do. Some of them had more skills than others, but nobody wasn't doing the best that they could do. It's not that they're out there slacking. They're doing the best that they can do, but they're in a situation where it's just real tough to be successful. Boy, I'm blabbing.
That's fine. That's the point. I'm just asked the questions and push you on, so that's fine. This became very personal for you in your last 2 years of education.
It did.
This became a very personal battle for you with your staff. And I don't know how much of that you want to talk about, but you are retired, so I think you're fairly safe at this point.
Well, it wasn't a battle with me and my staff. Together, me and my staff, not between me and my staff. I have absolutely the greatest staff in the world. I'm not going to miss the job. I'm going to miss the people terribly. These people have killed themselves. We've had consultants come in and work with us on getting up to speed on the new standards and scales and breaking down, deconstructing. My teachers work their butts off.
Just as a quick side note for listeners, specifically in this case, we're talking about LSI, right?
Yes.
So, which is a Learning Sciences Institute.
I didn't know
which
what
is
I couldn't
run
say.
Run by the Marzano company, which are a lot of schools in Florida or a lot of counties in Florida use the Marzano evaluation model to evaluate their teachers. So, an LSI is the branch he created to further monetize what was originally just a research paper based on other people's research.
Which is true. That's my son. Which is all true. However, I will say I don't have a problem with the Marzano instrument. The way it's designed, the way it's used is a different story. And I've had no trouble with the LSI people that came in and worked with us. They were fantastic. They definitely made a huge difference in my school. We went from a C the last 2 years, missed the B by 1 point and 2 points, to an A this year, which is a nice way to retire. But I know that it was because of the work we did with LSI. So my teachers worked themselves to death and they got it, and we knew it was going to happen. And LSI told us it would happen this year, not last year, when they worked with us. And the problem was that my former boss came in the day before spring break. All you teachers listening to this, I want that in your mind. It's the day before spring break, okay? And she's going through classrooms and saw a few things that weren't as rigorous and up to speed as they should have been, given that it was the day before spring break. She proceeded to tell me that I was running more of a country club than a school, that my teachers were way too relaxed and smiling. Nobody seemed worried or pressured about anything, and there was no way I'd get an A or B running a school that way. It was done a lot more mean than that, very, very unprofessional and personal. And it is what caused me to retire a year earlier than I had originally planned. The nice part is we did just what I knew we were going to do. I would never have predicted we'd get the A. I knew we were going to be a good solid B, which is what our goal was. But the A was a nice way to go out. We also, the test that we give to K1 and 2 to measure math and ELA scores were off the charts too. I mean, there was only one school in the entire district that was ahead of us in every one of the six categories. So, I mean, for a 100% Title I school, we did a phenomenal job. So, I mean, it kind of was thumbing my nose a little bit as I went out. But it's the pressure, and how much of it is just that person or how much of it comes from above her, I don't know. But the pressure really is there. And they tell us at the beginning of the year, we want you to have balance. We want you to take care of yourself, take care of your health, take care of your family, take care of your staff. Unfortunately, for the most part, we don't really think that they mean it, because really what it comes down to is if you're not getting an A or B, you're not going to be sticking around very long, which I don't know how I managed to stay at the school for 10 years because we weren't always an A or a B. So, but I'm glad I did. And I was very lucky.
So the personal side of that, I relate to a lot, having had my fair share of less than professional or effective managers and bosses, both in and out of education. And I get that part of it. But what I find interesting about this, so let's talk about this briefly after your annoying cuckoo clock.
Where's my clock?
My father is the only person in the world, I think, who still has clocks that make noise in his house.
Like, only
why,
one.
Why do we need this?
Only one, because it sounds nice.
Well, there used to be more than one.
There used to be, and even I got nuts trying to keep them all synchronized.
Yeah, that was the real, his like some OCD issues, and keeping them all synced was driving him insane.
Well, and so. Sammy kept pulling on the cable. That's my granddaughter, so I had to stop that one.
And it goes on forever.
It's almost done. Four more counts now. And the
former music person.
There we go.
There we go. Great. All right. So what I find interesting is your initial premise is that we're buying the lie that a teacher can overcome all of these obstacles, and then simultaneously saying that the work of you and your teachers overcame all of those obstacles at your school.
It overcame it this year. That's the problem. We've had an A three times while I've been a principal, and every year we slip back to a B the next year. It's hard to keep. And that, again, goes back to the system, because to get a learning gain every year used to be if a kid scored a level three and then the next grade he scored a level three, you got a learning gain. It's not true anymore. He's got to stay level three and improve a certain number of points. So what happens, and what we found this year analyzing the scores, is a lot of our higher kids did not get the learning gains because they may have barely gotten a four in it last year. They didn't keep that four this year, or they barely kept the four and it wasn't enough points to get the learning gains. So we got the learning gains a lot from our lower kids, and we got the on grade level from the upper kids, which is how the original system actually worked, because you got credit for the improvement of the kids who weren't on grade level and you got credit for the kids that were on grade level. They changed the system a little bit. It remains to be seen whether they can keep that A or not. And that's the problem. What I'm afraid of is what's happened before, is we're one of those schools that jumps from a C to an A and then next year we're right back to a B again. It gets hard to keep it.
My question is, when you talk about that, so looking at the measurement system the way it is, you're advocating basically the learning gains would be the learning gains, and then the kids that are on grade level, if they stay on grade level, you get points for them.
Right.
My issue becomes, and this is where a lot of I sometimes point to as one of our problem focuses, we're talking about kids, like, let's say bottom 25, right?
Right.
We spend time and effort on bottom 25. In some places it's bottom 20, sometimes it's bottom 15, but whatever.
Right.
Regardless, we spend boatloads of effort. We analyze that data and we get a green, yellow, and red report, and we immediately focus on the red. So is it not as important that an on-grade level kid the year before make a gain from where they were the year before?
Absolutely. But then that problem becomes management of time. It's like you said, we get those reports and we right away are looking at the red kids, because what matters in the district is we've got to get the people up to grade level. what matters to get that school grade, you got to come up to grade level. So what happens is we actually interviewed a teacher a couple weeks ago for a position next year. And we asked her, what do you do between the lowest and the highest? What do you do to close that learning gap? And she said in the interview, teach to the middle. No, that's not what we want to do, because that's what happens now is we teach to the middle and those higher kids don't get pushed because we look at them and say, okay, they're going to be on grade level. Let's get these kids up, the bubble kids and the lower kids. Let's get them up so we've got more people on grade level.
So you're running your school, you're running your district, you're running your state. You have ultimate control, wave a magic wand, problem's fixed. What's the first thing you change to fix the problem? Where do we point to?
That's a tough question, because honestly, I think some of the problem now is because we've decided that teachers can overcome everything else, that we have started putting less and less responsibility on students and parents. We've shifted it all over to the teachers because, for example, we use a program at schools in our district called iReady, which is a computer program, and the kid takes a diagnostic at the beginning of the year. Based on that, they're given a level to work on, and that gives automatic lessons as they go up. So it's not used instead of the classroom. It's used as an adjunct in centers and at home. We had parents
specifically for reading, or is it reading and
reading
math?
Reading and math, okay. Yeah. We had a parent one time in a conference that said, well, he's getting on iReady every day. And we pulled the report, said, sir, he's never been on iReady. Well, I'm sending him up to get on the computer every day. There's not the follow through with the parents. Said, what is he doing on the computer? He's playing a game. He's not doing any of that kind of stuff. We have parents that tell us all the time, school is your responsibility. I don't have time. I don't have the desire. You're the teacher. I'm not. And those kids, the ones I worry about the most, like I say, if our Hispanic kids could take the FSA in Spanish, we'd never have to worry about our grade, because it's not that they're not smart, it's that they haven't acquired the language. So those kids go home and they go home and speak Spanish all the time at night and on the weekends. Then they come back and have to do the English again when they get here. So those are the biggest things that we're having. We are taking the responsibility away from the parents and the students. It's always, we had a parent that didn't want their kid to take music, art, and PE, because she's so involved in extracurricular stuff after school, she doesn't have time to do homework, so she wants her to miss classes during the day at school to do her homework. We have others that just flat tell us that I'm not going to get him on the computer. There's too much of that out there, so they're never getting on iReady. So it's those kinds of things that we're trying to overcome all the time, and there's no way to grade the parents, obviously, but until we can get more support from them, that would make a big difference if there was more responsibility. We give them more rights all the time, but we don't give them responsibilities to go along with this. Responsibility is all on the educators.
Okay. What, I imagine a system, and I've thought about this before and I think it'd be really cool, but what if you didn't get any of your child-based tax credits unless your kid was passing school?
That would certainly get people's attention.
Get their attention. Like if
there
your
should
kid
be
isn't
some
at least
kind
like
of
a
way.
C or a D, they have to have a C or D average in school or else no tax credits.
And the private schools are able to do stuff like that where they're required to volunteer a certain number of hours or things like that if their kid's going to be in that school. So it's kind of a forcing them to be active. And a lot of it is that if the parents just were more aware of what was going on at the school and what we need their help with. And we do all kinds of FSA nights and Building Better Readers nights and math nights. I mean, we do all these evening events and the parents come. But it's the follow-up when they're back home. And I mean, I'm not knocking the parents. Like I said, a lot of them, they're doing absolutely the best they can. People you say all the time, they're sending you their best kids. They're not keeping the best ones home. They are sending our best kids and they're doing the best they can. But I think there's sometimes where maybe we let them off the hook. And I don't mean necessarily as a school, but I mean, every time somebody goes to Tallahassee, they get a new law made that a parent has more rights. Now, the last one was they have more rights to decide what books can and can't be in a media center or what can and can't be in the curriculum. That's a little bit dangerous at that point, because the people who don't have the information and aren't in the business are the ones making the decision. But that's where the school grade stuff comes from, too, is the legislatures who aren't in education.
I was going to say, I think maybe we're talking about the real problem here, and that is communication. Because you're talking about parents don't know what's going on at the school. The local administrator doesn't seem to know what's going on at the school. And I've talked about this a lot from a teacher's perspective. They only know what's going on inside their four walls. Like, there's a genuine lack of transparency.
Well, and that's something that I have really tried to do as a principal, because every time I would come back from a principal's meeting, first thing I would do is sit down and put out an email to the entire staff. Here's what happened at the principal's meeting today. Boom, 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 boom. I would subscribe to a newsletter that daily came out with educational things from the legislature, and I would forward that to them. So I really worked hard to make sure that my teachers knew what was going on, because what I realized when I did my master's was Every teacher should have the information I was getting in my master's program. Why should I, as an administrator, have this knowledge when the people that really need it are the ones in the classroom? That's why I had an open door policy, and I really tried to keep my my staff informed of this kind of stuff. And I think it helped them. If nothing else, it let them see better that, okay, this decision he had nothing to do with, so we've got to do it, whatever. But this decision was his, and we can be mad at him for it, and we can talk to him about it. This one, there's no choice. So I think that helped him a lot. But I think you're right, the communication piece. I also sent a Wednesday message home every week to my parents that would explain this kind of stuff. And, you know, sometimes it's, please follow the rules in the car line, or we've got McDonald's Spirit Night coming up. But a lot of times I used it to say, you know, this is why we're using iReady. This is why it's important for your child to get on it every day. So, I mean, you're right. It is that communication.
So you think that communication is one of the keys to your success at your school this last year?
I think so. I think it has been overall, is that it's always been an open policy. And I think what helped that is I was the AP 3 years before I became the principal, so there really was no transition. It just, you know, I moved four doors up the hallway, but everything kind of kept going the way that it had been because I had had a hand in how it was going anyway. So, yeah, I've been big on that, you know, when I was a high school band director, making sure that my students knew everything that was going on when you're talking about no pass, no play and that stuff when that came around in the 80s and the 90s. So I think you have to be open with the people that are working with or around or for you, or you can't. I have a very big leadership team. I have a 9-member leadership team, which is big for an elementary school. But I did it because they have better knowledge than me in specific areas. And if we all share it, it helps them to see, oh, this is why he's not fully implementing what I want him to implement in math, because he's got this in ELA and he's got this in science, he's got this in other stuff. So I think any way you can communicate helps.
Okay. We may have already touched on this, but it seems like a good transition. And obviously, slightly modified, the question would normally be, what are you doing that you wish everyone else would do? I guess, in this case, what did you do that you wish now that you don't do anything anymore?
I think that's the biggest thing, is the communication. I honestly can say, in 7 years as a principal and 3 as an AP, there were maybe a handful of decisions throughout the entire time that I made on my own. Now, I take responsibility for all of them, because as the principal, you know, it's like I always said, it's like a baseball manager. You get too much credit when you win and too much blame when you lose. But that is who you are. You're the face, you know, you're the bottom line that they can't blame on anybody else. But I never made, or rarely made decisions without making sure I had other opinions. First of all, because I always carried a chip on my shoulder of having been a music teacher and afraid I didn't understand the curriculum and the day-to-day stuff of a teacher that has the same kids all day long. I never had that. But also because, I mean, I had a reading coach because she was great at reading. I had a math coach because she was great at math. All the people that I had in that team were because they were very, very much experts in their opinion or in their area. And you can't do that as a principal. There's just too many ways, too many things going on for you to be the expert in all of them. You're the final word, but that final word shouldn't come until you've had a lot of discussion with a lot of people. And I think my teachers always felt that they had a lot of say, whether it was just the team leaders or, you know, I just would open it up to anybody. Say, you know, hey, what do you guys think of this? What would be the best way to handle this? I think they buy into it a lot more if they feel that they're part of it. And I think that's been part of the thing the last several years, is a lot of times they feel like they're just being given things to do without. They always tell you don't put something on somebody's plate without taking somebody else or something else off. And that's not what we've done the last 5-6 years. What we've done is just keep giving bigger plates as we give them more stuff. And what I called it all the time was taking the bullets for them, so that the district would say, you got to do this, 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 and this. And I would then go back to my leadership team and say, okay, here's what they're saying. How do we make that work the way our school does it? And how do we boil it down? And what do we absolutely have to do? And what can we wait on? And I think my staff respected that, and I think they knew from talking to friends at other schools that we were doing as much of that as we could to let them really focus on the main things they need to focus on.
Okay. So transparency and communication, involving your staff in decision-making, those are things that you would like
Absolutely.
To see all administrators do?
Absolutely. I didn't like surprises as a principal, and I didn't want my teachers ever to be surprised. If they're having an issue, if a parent calls me because they got an issue with a teacher, my response would always be, have you spoken to the teacher? No, I don't want to. I want to talk to you. Well, I'm sorry. I'm not in the room. You're not in the room. The teacher's in the room. You got to talk to her. So, I mean, it's that having their back and letting them know that I'm not going to sandbag them and surprise them with things, that they're going to know when things are coming.
Okay. Cool. In whatever number of years it has been my life, I don't think I've ever asked you this question. So I'm kind of excited to hear your answer to my third question. Who is the best teacher you ever had?
Oh, you want me to give a name?
Yeah, give a name.
Wow.
I mean, you did just retire, so chances are they're dead. They're not going
to
be offended.
The best teacher I ever had as a, yeah. when I was a student. Okay, yeah. good. That's what you wanted me to...
No, not a staff member. No,
okay. Wow. There would be... I don't know that I could narrow it down to one. The interesting thing is, I will tell you, I grew up in Joliet, Illinois. Way to go, Joliet. I can name every elementary school teacher I had, K through 5. I never have forgotten any of the names. They were all great teachers. And today, when I was cleaning out the attic, we actually found my kindergarten picture, and I was able to not name about 75% of the kids in that picture. So, I mean...
Barely remember what you had for breakfast.
Yeah, well,
but
that's
you
true.
Can name but we your had, kindergarten
we had
class.
An excellent education. So I would say in elementary school, Ms. Voigt was my kindergarten teacher. I think that is so important that they get off to that great start, and she was wonderful. And 30 years later, I saw her at a grocery store, and she remembered me as that kid that kept banging on the desk. Yes, I was, because I was a drummer. And so that was...
Trust me, then my audience knows that, because you've still done it repeatedly.
I know.
You're better than usual, but...
Junior high would have been my band director, Donald Johnson. Because he really pushed me as a leader. I had been in the band since first grade. You're not supposed to get in it till fourth or fifth. And so, you know, we got over there and I acted older than I was and tended to have a little more of a temper and less patience with people who weren't up to where I was. And it wasn't that I was great. It was that I had a lot more practice. And he was real good at, well, he actually typified what we talked about earlier. He had special times during the week where just he and I would sit down and he would push me and teach me more about music or about other instruments besides percussion or stuff like that because they knew I needed that. So he would have been one. And then in high school, my English teacher, Mr. Bennington, I had him freshman and sophomore year. He was this older guy, and yet he kept up with everything. I remember he and I having a long conversation about the rock opera Tommy because the movie was just coming out by The Who. And it was just fascinating, first of all, that this old guy knew about it and would sit down at that. And he's the one that turned me on to Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. I probably read those books 10 times in my lifetime. So he really saw what a student needed and really pushed him in that direction. So I don't know that I could have ever knocked it down to one, but those were elementary, junior high, and high school.
Interesting to me that almost all of those experiences, other than the kindergarten teacher, which are sort of non-specific about, but the other ones are all very much involving a teacher taking the time to get to know you and
Absolutely.
Finding your interests and giving those to
That's
you.
That's the key. The kids don't care what you know till they know that you care. I got that right once. Usually I screwed up. And we tell the teachers that all the time, and that impressed me this summer. We did a lot of interviews, and one of the questions we'd ask was, what's the most important thing for a teacher to accomplish with their students? And almost every single one said, you have to have the relationship first. You have to have that relationship. And I think that's part of the problem in schools now is you read the research and it says the more consistency there is in leadership in the school level, the better school is going to do. And yet we don't follow that a lot of times. We're moving principals after 2-3 years, and that's not enough, especially as big as some of our schools are. That's not enough time. So if you're bringing in somebody with a different philosophy every 2 or 3 years, that's really tough. That's why at my school, we've been open 11 years now, and over 60% of the teachers have been there since we opened. And most of the ones that weren't, it's because we grew and we added people. They don't leave because there's been that consistency up in the front.
I mean, that transient rate, by the way, is just astronomically low compared to to have a school that's been open 11 years and 60% of the people have been there that long. That's ridiculous.
I know.
That doesn't happen in our area.
I know. And that's why I think that my boss thought things were a little lax is because we all know each other so well that they know exactly how far they can go and be creative and still make sure they're teaching the standards. And obviously this year we got the A, so it worked.
Having been on the administrative side, why is that the thought process? Why do we constantly change?
I don't know. And it's not the administrator's fault. We all used to dread June and July, that tap on the shoulder you'd get in a training, and they'd call you to the back of the room and say, by the way, that's not your school anymore. I don't know.
And also, by the way, for anybody that doesn't know, that is literally how it has been done in our district multiple years. They literally will have the leadership summit of the principals and APs, and the area directors will come in and tap you on the shoulder, pull you to a different room, tell you you don't go there anymore, go sit at this table when you go back into the room.
Yeah, it's not a way to do things. But I'm not sure why they do it so often. We've never been able to see any kind of a pattern to what they do, because we'll see a person that's been in an A school and they're moving to either C or D. Okay, that makes sense. We want to get this school up. But then we all see people that have been C or D or F schools that are moving to A or B schools. I don't know if the thought there is this guy screwed up so bad we're going to put him somewhere where it won't matter. I don't know. But it's always been, I mean, people moving from elementary to high school or middle school. I mean, they never wanted to do that. We're never asked, by the way. They hammer the point home that once you're an administrator, you give up tenure, you're free to be moved at any time by the superintendent. They remind us of that all the time. So it's never that they come to us. I remember only one time in my 10 years as administrator that somebody took a survey and said, "What are your goals for your career?" So that I could honestly say at that point, I don't ever want to be out of elementary school. I've taught high school. I've taught middle school. I don't want to do it. I want to be an administrator only in elementary school. And I was able to stay there. But that's the one time. And that was like my first year as a principal, maybe my last year's AP. So we're talking 7, 8 years ago. And that's three bosses ago. So that's the only time that we were ever asked. So it's not ever a matter of, where do you think you would do good? What would you like to do? It's a matter of, oh, okay, we think you'll do good over here. And so you dread that June and July when you're being moving around like that.
Well, maybe you're touching on the bigger issue, which is that the people above you and the people above them and the people above them have changed out every 2 to 3 years too. We True. Change structure, we change organization, we change the rules, we change the standards, we change the formats, we change the templates, we change the curriculum, we change everything. Every single thing is a variable in this equation, and we don't leave any of them constant.
Absolutely. In my 10 years as an administrator, I had 4 different area superintendents. That's my direct boss. I had 4 different ones. I was one as an AP, and then it had changed by the time I became a principal. And I had 3 different ones in 7 years as a principal. And all of them approached it very, very differently. And again, how much of that was those individual people and how much of that was from above, I don't know. But it is hard to know or to keep a direction when you really don't know what's coming down the road with the next person, with the next boss.
I wonder if that is an educational unique phenomenon, or if it has something to do with the way education is structured and a current phenomenon. I mean, we've all seen the studies that the average person my age will have right. 7 or 8 different careers, or at least different opportunities and businesses and jobs or anything else, versus someone of your generation, or even especially the generation before you, where, you know, grandpa stayed with the same company for how many years?
Yeah, for until he retired.
Yeah. So 30 years. That is a difference. And so, is that more of an educational phenomenon, or do you think it's a consequence of a changing landscape in work?
Well, I don't know, because I've never really, I mean, I spent a couple years as a computer programmer and a couple years as a associate pastor at a Methodist church before I finished my education degree. But as far as like regular, what you think day-to-day work, I've always been in education, so I don't know. But I know that there wasn't that constant change in my early years as there is now. But you know, again, I was a band director, so I wouldn't have been quite as much a part of that. But I know just from having teacher friends all the years that that wasn't changing. I mean, just in the 7 years I've been an administrator, we've had 3 different sets of standards and 3 different assessments and 3 or 4 different ways of judging, you know, what the school grade will be. I mean, it changes all the time. So, and then what happens is you end up presenting these things to teachers, and they basically say, why? It's going to change in 2 years. I mean, they rolled out a plan last year for MTSS, and they said it's a 5-year plan. And as soon as they said 5-year plan, every principal in the room went, oh, well, then we don't have to listen to the rest of this because we never make it past year 2 of a 5-year plan. So, I mean, and that's, you know, if we're thinking that as a principal, then how do you not have your teachers think, okay, well, they want me to do this now, but, you know, in 2 years, am I going to be doing the same thing? So that is tough when it's constantly changing and you don't know what's coming next. Apparently, from what I understand, they're taking some of the Marzano elements out.
Yeah, they're putting us down to like 12 or something.
Marzano light. I had read about that earlier.
They're doing Marzano light. That's new.
Well, if you want to know the number one issue in our district, I can tell you what that is.
What's that?
Micromanagement.
Well, yes.
That is the biggest problem because the previous superintendent was very smart. We have a huge district. Huge.
We've talked about that on my podcast before.
Yeah,
but
very big. And so they broke us up into learning communities. He realized you cannot run this many teachers, this many students, this many administrators, this many schools. You cannot do it from one central office. And so they broke it down to learning communities that each had some autonomy. That way, the Southeast, where I am, which is a very, very different demographic than the North or the East, were able to tailor the things they were doing for the communities that they were in. when we switched superintendents, all that got pulled back and it became consistency was what the name of it is. But it's micromanagement to where almost any decision I now make as a principal, I have to have cleared by my boss. We never had that before. Before, once you were a principal, and what they used to tell us, it is your building to run. If you have a question, ask me. I'll be more than happy to give you my opinion, but it is your building to run. Just know that whatever happens, you're going to be responsible for it. And that's not true anymore. We are less and less principals than we used to be because every single thing we do, in other words, if they tell us put a team together from your school to do this, great. 5 years ago, I'd have put the team together and we'd have gone and done whatever we need to do. No, now you put the team together and then you have to meet with your boss for her to approve all the people. So it's micromanagement, and that is one thing that really is I think going to have a detrimental effect. Our superintendent actually said once that she used the word cloning. She pulled it back real fast because she realized she shouldn't have said it, but she used the word cloning. She wants to be able to go from class to class and school to school and not see any difference at all. And I understand what she's saying is that every kid should get a good education. I completely agree. But what we've always tried to tell our teachers with our students in rooms is equal is not fair. There's a difference between the two. Kids can figure out that this kid's ADHD and has to walk around the room once in a while. Kids can figure that out. Adults have more problems with that. And that's where I think is the danger that we're saying is when we want all these vanilla, homogenized classes where you can go from one to one to one to one and they're all the same, then I'm not sure anybody's getting a great education because that teacher isn't getting to use their specific skills, which is why I hired that person. And it's that micromanagement. They want everything to be the same. And I don't think it should be the same because I don't think if it's the same that all the kids are getting a fair education.
Well, and we've talked about in the podcast in general and just in education across the board, like differentiation and individualized learning is everything. That doesn't happen if it's all cookie cutter. You can't just make, even if you did, like, their vision of differentiated or individualized learning is you are one of three models. Like, then we're not just the exact same. We're three different kids in the room. Like, that's pretty much it. And that doesn't work. And yep. There's always this, I feel like, a constant contradiction between what we know to be instructionally sound practice based on research and based on everything else and what the district or the legislative or whatever actually wants to have happen, and it's a constant struggle. And certainly the micromanagement component of it is critical. Like no one really wants to work in that kind of an environment. But I want to bring this back a little bit, and what can a classroom teacher do in the system we have in place to make sure their kids learn?
The biggest thing is to make sure, first of all, that they're teaching to the standards. Because our standards are new, we're still getting some teachers that had that wonderful lesson that they used to love to teach, but it's not part of that grade level standards anymore. It's real hard to get them to give that up, especially elementary teachers. I think they get real territorial and they love those lessons. So that's one thing is to make sure.
I just want to point out, by the way, teachers are the age of their students. Elementary school teachers don't like to share. They still have trouble with sharing.
Oh, that's true. Oh, I've always said that the teachers behave like the grade level they teach. I did a whole presentation to my staff at Post Planning 1 year just for fun, saying, if I put out something to the staff, says, here, we're going to make this change. If it's for kindergarten, I've got to put out a month ahead of time so they can first all get together and cry, and then we can slowly bring them back. Fifth grade, I can say, we got to do this. Say, okay, fine, we got it. And every variation in between. But I think that's number one is that they have to make sure they're attached to the standards. That is one thing that has been good. See, I've never had any problems with Common Core, the dreaded Common Core, which, of course, we don't do in Florida, right?
We do Common Core plus cursive.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is.
It's Common Core and cursive.
And we only said plus something so that we could tell people, no, we're not doing Common Core.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have no problem with Common Core. I have no problem with Common Standards. As much as people move from state to state, I think that's probably a good thing. But here's the perfect example. They should all be teaching the standards, but they have to be teaching them at a level where their kids are at. For instance, last year in our district, we were told right at the beginning of the year, if you go into a classroom for an observation and a teacher is not teaching it at the level of the standard, they get a low rating. Well, how fair is that? It's September, 2/3 of their class doesn't speak English. There's no way they can be teaching at the level of the standard. It's supposed to be. And I think what they also forget is the standard is to be reached at the end of the year, not in September. But they're going in every year in September and saying, oh, they're teaching too low. Well, yes, they're teaching low because 2/3 of these kids never spoke Spanish till a year and a half ago. And they came from this kid's been in six different schools. This one just came from Venezuela. You can't start at the level of the standard. You've got to start where the kids are at and get them there. One thing we pushed at our my school with my staff is we tended to start everybody back at basically level one and go from there. And it was hard to get them out of doing that and saying, look, start at level three, see who needs the extra, and go back and give those kids the extra. But if people are coming in to observe you, and you've been told that if you're not teaching at the level of the standard, you're not going to get a good rating. Then when they come in to observe, you teach at that level, and two-thirds of your kids don't know what you're doing. So we don't think things through. Standards are great, but standards are supposed to be at the end of the year, not in September. And we need to be able to make sure we're watching that and that we're monitoring that, because my kids aren't going to be in September where schools on the east side of town are going to be in September.
Okay, so biggest advice for an individual teacher is focus on your standards.
Focus on the standards. Work together with your team. Our teams do collaborative planning every week so that as I go down the room from teacher to teacher to teacher, for the most part, I do see that they're on the same lesson on the same day. They're not all approaching it the same way. They're doing it for what best fits their students. This one has more ELL kids. This one has the gifted kids. This one has a few ESE kids. So they're approaching it at the level that it needs to be for their kids, but they're all working. And that's as far as I ever felt we needed to go as far as the micromanagement or the consistency, was that I didn't walk down the hall and see this kid, this class is doing geometry while this one's doing writing and this one's doing social studies while this one's having snack time. You know, you get to where they are, they have a schedule and they keep on to the standards. But that's what the collaborative planning did, was make sure everybody kept up.
Okay. So I think that's an interesting point to talk on, because I think connected educator, common planning, PLCs, common assessment, there's a lot of buzzwords floating around right now and have been for a while, but talking about PLC, and as you talk about this transient factor where our kids move around a lot, this is important. But I think a critical point you made there is that planning together doesn't mean you are clones of each other.
Exactly.
I think that's the point. And I've experienced that personally with a phenomenal team, with my seventh grade English team when I was doing that. And we planned together every single day. I mean, we had common planning time. We had met before school. We usually have lunch together. And it was every day. And it was the three of us. And we would do everything together. We plan our lessons. But you didn't walk into all three rooms and see the exact same thing happen
at
the same
time.
I would hate
that. I would hate to see that, because some kid's not getting taught the way he needs to be taught if every room is being approached the same. Because there's no way in the world. We do our best during the summer to schedule the classes so that the kids are, you know, as equal from teacher to teacher, but it doesn't stay that way because kids come out, kids come in. So no, I would never want to do that. And the whole key is that common planning. And we went to all the once a week. They meant more than that, but we went once a week as administrators. And the original goal of that was to make sure they were focused on the standards and they could sit. We didn't even have to do it. They had it. We basically could sit back and just say, okay, this is great. Type up my notes and put them on the SharePoint. So no, you would not ever want to see exactly the same thing, because somebody's not getting taught right if everybody's doing it exactly the same way.
So would a more effective model be something where students aren't so directly tied to an individual teacher all the time? In other words, when you know you have a student that's strong in one, like especially in English or in elementary, for example, if they're really strong in English, they go to we have a high, middle, low teacher. Would that be a better model?
And we do some of that. We departmentalize in fourth and fifth grade to where half the team teaches ELA, the other half teaches math and science. So we have started to do that in fourth and fifth grade, and it's worked really well. And I'm sure that's part of why we moved up to the A's, because the teachers were able to focus on what their strength was. In other words, you got one that's really strong in ELA and one that's strong in math. You team them together, and they have the kids half the day, and then they swap. So it's the same curriculum. It works out great for discipline, too, because if this kid's got three or four he's not getting along with, you just switch him to the other teacher. So he's still got the same two teachers, just a different time of the day. That worked really good. We did some with our first graders last year where we were doing intervention time where they would move around to different teachers so that you could address the high, middle, and the low. There gets to be a couple. I would like to do more of it, but there's a couple of problems with it. First of all, a school as big as mine is, where I have 10, 11 teachers on a grade level, it gets real hard to be moving first graders around because, you know, they get in the hallway and look what's hanging on the wall. So that gets a little bit harder. The other problem with it is, because of the lovely VAM scores, they are tied in the computer to specific students. And what you'll have is teachers say, okay, I'm teaching the low kid during interventions. I should get credit for that, but I'm not, because they're not my kids. And the computer system doesn't have a way to assign them in an elementary school like you can in a middle school and a high school, where they're going from class to class. So that is a little bit, the VAM score becomes a problem. But now,
real quick for the audience, VAM is that value-added model, as it's called, and that's the paying teachers for performance of their students portion. That's where their test scores are tied directly to our bonuses and our pay as teachers.
So it gets harder to just say, all right, let's send this group over to Mrs. So-and-so instead of their regular teacher because Mrs. So-and-so isn't tied to them anymore on the computer, so they don't get the credit. And so then you end up having issues with the union because teachers are teaching kids that aren't necessarily assigned to them.
Also, they're because they're the union and they're terrible. There's also that.
Well, I never joined it in 29 years, so...
I'm not anti-union in general. I'm just anti-our union because they're annoying. I don't like them.
Yeah, well, they got real annoying a couple years ago.
pretty bad, yeah.
But it's the first time... And you know, that's I'm off on a tangent, I'm sure. But that was the first time that... The only problem with that is she didn't know when to stop. But it was the first time that administration at the district level was called on the carpet to say, no, you can't do that to us. I mean, if it had been a different personality... The teachers might have gotten some really great things out of that, but they didn't because she rubbed everybody so badly that they basically eventually even the teachers booted her out because nothing was happening. But it was the first time, and I told the teachers this, it's the first time since I've been in education that I felt like downtown was actually listening to some of the problems of the teachers because this person made it impossible for them not to listen.
Yeah, made it impossible for all of us not to listen.
Yes.
It's a whole different set of problems. All right, what's the next big wave? From an administrative standpoint or just in your experience, watching the changes over the years you've been a teacher, what's the next big wave in education?
I know in our district they're starting what they're calling district PLCs this year, which is teams of teachers from each school that go to what used to be the principal's meetings. So that's going to be interesting. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work because I knew I wasn't going to be involved with it, so I didn't pay attention. But that's going to be different. All I see in our district is more and more micromanaging. I really, unfortunately, don't see that getting any less. I see that actually getting worse. And the problem with that is they go into classrooms looking for things that are wrong. And when that's your mindset, is that you're going into the room intent on finding things wrong, you can always find something wrong. But you're taking that negative attitude. They're not taking the attitude. They don't do what they tell us to do in their lovely summits that they have, which are blowing sunshine up your butt a couple times a year, once in the summer and once halfway through in January, where they tell you how wonderful everything is and we need to focus on the whole child and all this stuff that they say at those things and then forget them the rest of the year. But they're so focused on what each individual teacher is doing wrong. For example, like I said, I don't have a problem with the Marzano system. It's how we do it. Why is it assumed that teachers fall back to beginning and developing over the summer every year? I don't understand that. If you were giving applying to the beginning of the year, how can they be applying? It's only beginning of the year. We've had this system for 6 years. They know how to do it now, so they should be applying. They keep pushing it to the teachers as a growth model. It's a growth model. I've always called it a growth model where you're not allowed to grow because every year it starts over. And they do the same thing with us. The people in the front office honestly don't think that anybody in the schools knows anything about what they're doing, and they have to be retaught every single year. And that's what used to make me the maddest. But unfortunately, I don't see that going away. With this new education bill in the state this year, I don't know how all that's going to... I mean, they're doing things like they're going to make testing later in the year and go back to paper pencil, but make the results come back quicker. And there's not anybody in the world that thinks that's possible.
The one I liked was there was a bill that... And I don't know if this is the one that ended up passing or whatever. I stopped paying attention because it made me sad. But there was a bill that said all standardized testing, all state-required testing has to be done in the last 2 weeks of school and only in the last 2 weeks of school. Can't do it any other time. I have 4,200 kids in my school,
Each
taking a different set of 7 tests. That ain't happening. That's not a thing.
And because kids are having trouble on the computers, because we just started doing our computers, they're going to go everything back to paper and pencil. So that makes scheduling a little bit easier because they can do it in a classroom like we used to do. But how do they think they're going to get the results in 3 weeks? When nothing is computerized.
It takes a week just to organize your own school's results to send them in the paper.
Exactly.
It's a mess.
Yeah. I wish I saw something positive coming out of the pike. I'm worried because I'm worried nationally, and especially here in Florida, the push is charter school, charter school, charter school, charter school. To where now this latest bill is taking tax money from the public schools to help fund and build charter schools. And if you look at the results, they're no better than the public schools. There's really great ones and really lousy ones. But I'm afraid that because they're for profit and most politicians are businessmen, they and all their friends have gotten together and they're going to make everything charter schools. But again, that's people making decisions that don't know about education. And they've convinced people, and I think that's part of the problem with the parent. They've convinced the public that teachers don't know what they're doing. And I'm sure there's bad teachers. There's bad lawyers, there's bad policemen, there's bad politicians, there's bad everything. But the majority of them are good and working hard and doing the best that they can. And I think that's obviously true in the schools because they certainly didn't get into it for the money.
True. Well, we're getting pretty close to the end of our time here. I have one last thing, and you've listened to some of the episodes of my podcast, not all of them, but you've listened to some. And I've often said, and I'm wondering if you're in agreement here, but people have asked me before, what's the goal of my podcast? And my response has been that I essentially would like to convince one or maybe more than one teacher to just go rogue. Just abandon the thought process, abandon what the district leadership or even school leadership, depending on where they are, is at, and just goes and does what's good for their kids. Is that a model, now that you are a retired principal, that you could potentially
perfect.
Support?
And I have said many times, so interesting that you say that, because I've said many times during the years, if we would leave them all alone to teach, we would be amazed at what they could do. If we would get out of their way. In other words, if the colleges are doing their job, and what I've seen, at least here, UCF, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that or not, but man, I've hired every single person that was ever an intern. I hired them right away, and everybody that ever came in, they are preparing students great. And I'm sure other schools are too, but that's just the local one. But if you get the people that are prepared, and in the interview, you're looking, and I tell people this all the time that are interviewing, I'm looking at your personality, because you're going to answer the questions the same every single person, veteran, how do you teach reading? Well, you start with whole group, and you go to, I know all this stuff. I'm looking at your personality, and then you work together with your team to make sure you're on the standards, and then say, okay, now go do that. I swear we would see test scores go through the roof if you took some of the things away from teachers that were telling them they have to do, because they know what they're supposed to do and they know how to do it. I'm banging the table again. I'm sorry.
That's fine. You've done it the whole time.
Now, I would love that. I wish they would just pick one school and say, you know what? We're going to leave you alone this year. Show us what you can do. My school, we would have killed. If we had that, we would have knocked it out of the park. I guarantee you, if we had been able to just say, let's do what we know will work for our students, and let's see what happens. I would love to see that.
The problem is none of that is research-based practice. And if it's not research-based, we don't have data to support it.
We're very selective of what we pay attention to research-based, because there's a lot of things research-based that we ignore. We only follow the research-based stuff that we think fits with what we're doing.
Well, we only follow research-based practices when they apply directly to students. When it's research about education as a whole, we ignore that. Like, consistency in leadership. Nah, we don't need that. Yeah, exactly. But research says, nah, that doesn't count. But research based on student performance, that we follow up directly, 100%. That we got to follow. But if it's about schools, nah. When I teach my night classes, I often will say, oh, well, we talk about grading in one of my classes, and I say, avoid systems that reduce the number of high or low grades. You don't want to create this perfect bell curve. We only use bell curve when we're grading teachers. And it's so many things I will tell them is not good practice in education is how we run education.
Exactly. And I know I'll never be invited to speak to upcoming principals, they would never let me anywhere near them. But I did that on occasion. And one of the things I used to tell them is, they will tell you they don't have to like you. They don't have to, just have to respect you. That's crap. They do have to like you because they aren't going to work for you. And I think that's what has happened in my school in the 10 years is the first principal and me, we all did get along. We all liked each other. When I hired somebody to replace somebody, I was either looking for somebody just like that or completely opposite of that, whatever it was. But we kept making sure that our teams worked together that way. And I think because we were positive about each other, that was why we've had the success that we have, particularly this past year, because they knew we were up against it. I mean, all you got to do is tell teachers, if this doesn't happen, you're going to lose your team or you're going to be moved over here, and they will do it. You don't have to hit them over the head.
All right. I think across the board, our message here today is really to trust the teachers, trust the administrators, trust the people you've put in place. And
why do you hire people that you then don't trust to do their job?
Because they figure they got hired and probably don't deserve to have their job anyways.
Well, I'm afraid that a lot of times they are working out of fear, because I know what it can be like at those cabinet meetings. I've heard, and I can understand to a point why they are that way. They are afraid. Because like, they get moved around too.
It's the consequence of imposter syndrome. Like they feel like every day they're going to wake up and realize they don't, that someone else is going to realize they don't know what they're doing.
I used to always tell Sherry, smoke and mirrors. That's how I get. I told my staff at the end of the year, I said, I've made a career out of being marginally talented, but really nice. And it's worked for me by surrounding myself with people who knew more than me and then saying, good, go do your job. And it's worked.
And as a as an employee, that's what you want to work under, right? You want to have that freedom to do your job. So, cool. Well, Dad, I'm sure you will be bored out of your mind for the coming forever as you no longer work. So you'll probably be back on the show.
Everybody thinks that. Nope. I'd love to be back on the show, but believe me, I'm not going to be bored at all. I spent all day today cleaning out the attic. I've been retired 3 days. I'm up cleaning out the attic. So I'm not
right. Well, at some point, you're going to run out of attics to clean.
Hopefully this one. That was
not fun. All right, Dad. Well, thank you for sitting with me.
Thank you. This was fun. Yeah.
Man, that was fun. I usually don't like editing these episodes. Who really enjoys listening to recordings of their own voice, honestly? But as I edited through this one, I had a smile on my face. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as well. If you did like what you heard, do me a favor and give me a rating on iTunes. You can go to tinyurl.com/planningperiodreview to get straight to my iTunes page and make it easy for you. Or just reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at Brad Shuffler, and you can message me down there anytime. Thank you, as always, to Kevin MacLeod for our opening and closing music, Vicious. You can find him at incompetech.com. And humongous thank you to my good friend, Sarah Johnson, who made us our new logo, which will be the logo for the Planning Period podcast going forward. It is awesome. If you haven't seen it, go check it out at bradstreffler.com or just update your podcatching app and it should have the new icon for you. And lastly, we are back to every week releases, so you will hear from me again in a week. Until then, maybe think about going rogue in your classroom.